Okay, so I think that's everybody pretty much settled down here. So tonight's talk is going to be about samatha and vipassana. These two words are two very important words in Buddhism. And if you haven't heard them before, then samatha is usually translated as calm in most places where you read about Buddhist teachings. And vipassana is often translated as insight. And tonight I'm also going to suggest an alternative translation for this term, vipassana. But usually insight is a term which is used in most places. And these two terms are extremely central in the Buddha's teachings, because this is essentially what mental culture is all about. Buddhist teaching is basically about mental culture, how we develop our mind from the very beginning all the way to full enlightenment. And these two things are the essence, the core aspect of that mental culture. We cultivate our minds two ways. One is in calm, samatha. The other way is in vipassana, which is like insight. So the whole Buddhist path can essentially be viewed as a combination of these two characteristics, insight and calm. The whole path from the beginning to the very end is nothing really but insight and calm, samatha and vipassana combined in various combinations. And I know that many people sometimes go on the vipassana retreats where they learn what they call vipassana meditation. And if you go on a retreat with Ajahn Brahm, like the retreat was happening at the moment, then you're doing what they would call a samatha meditation. Because Ajahn Brahm is most famous for his samatha, his calming techniques. And often people don't, it's very hard often to understand what is the exact difference between a vipassana meditation and samatha meditation. In fact, is there really all that much difference between the two? Could it be, in fact, that they are much more closely connected than we imagine that they are? And one of the things I want to talk about tonight is that essentially samatha and vipassana are very, very closely related to each other. And when you understand how they relate to each other, you will understand also how they interact and how they grow together on this Buddhist path from the beginning all the way to the end of the path, all the way to full enlightenment. And I also want to talk about how to use these techniques in daily life. How can we actually use these things in an ordinary, busy life to enhance our own spiritual practice and get a little bit closer to that final goal that we probably all are aspiring for ultimately. So first of all, samatha. Samatha is, as I said, is a calm, and samatha meditation is usually a technique for calming down the mind. And the most famous technique that is talked about in the suttas for calming the mind is the meditation called watching the breath. It's called anapanasati in the Pali language. It means mindfulness of the breath, watching the breath. And this is a teaching which the Buddha taught in many, many different places. And because he taught it in so many places, and because he showed how it leads from the very beginning, when you start off meditation, to the very end, because of that, it's a very powerful teaching, and it's a very important teaching because of that. So it's a teaching that we should always try to keep in mind. It's a difficult meditation practice, but because it is so important, it's something that we should always take into account in our meditation. We should try it out every now and again, certainly when we go on retreat. So this is the most important samatha technique, calm technique, to calm down your mind, is the watching the breath. But there are many, many, many other techniques as well. And these are all quite important, because sometimes it is difficult to calm your mind watching the breath. You may not be ready for it yet. You might still be too running around too much to be able to enable you to focus on the breath. But sometimes it's often important to realize that there's all these other techniques that we can use. And one of those is metta meditation, loving kindness or compassion. These are actually samatha techniques. These are calming techniques. We calm the mind by using metta, compassion, loving kindness as a meditation object. And there's also things like contemplation of the qualities of the Buddha, contemplation of the qualities of the Dhamma, contemplation of the Sangha. These are also important, because sometimes if we contemplate these things correctly, It will make us calmer. It will give sense to rise of happiness inside, make us feel peaceful, make us feel very serene inside of ourselves. So all of these techniques, and there's many, many, many more. Traditional, there's 40 meditation subjects, which all are about calm and samatha. And all of these techniques are that because they lead to a peaceful mind. So what actually happens when we do samatha meditation? And what actually happens, which is, I think is important to know, the primary thing which happens is that we are actually reducing the defilements, the problems inside the mind. In particular, we are letting go more and more deeply of anger, ill will, irritation. And also at the same time, we're also letting go of desire at the same time. And the point here is that both desire and ill will are qualities which take us out of the present moment. Desire is always about looking at an object which you haven't got here, right here and now. It's somewhere else. But because it is somewhere else, desire always takes you out of the present moment. In other words, it's the opposite of calm, opposite of contentment, opposite of just being in the present moment and being mindful. And ill will, irritation is the same. Your mind tends to go out to that object of ill will, always going to that object rather than staying in the here and now. It's exactly the same problem. So when we practice the calm meditation, when we are able to actually calm our mind down, then we are letting go of these defilements in the mind. We're making the mind much more pure by doing this calm meditation. And it's important to understand that this is an important facet of samatha meditation, that we are letting go of these defilements, which are so problematic in our lives, which sap us of so much happiness and contentment. So it's a beautiful thing what is actually happening there. But it's more than that. It's more than just letting go of defilements. It's also about giving rise to beautiful qualities in the mind. And the calm meditation gives rise to so many wonderful qualities. It gives rise to a sense of tranquility, peace, calm, often joyful states. All these wonderful things that we are seeking for. And the more the defilements go away, the more these other qualities will tend to arise in the mind. And when the defilements are completely gone, well, that's when you're starting to become really, really, really peaceful and really one-pointed. In fact, at that point, that is the point at which you can enter these deep states of samadhi here, that we are all, this deep states of concentration, meditation, that ultimately we might all be aspiring for. So that is just a little bit about samatha, how samatha makes us, appeases the mind, makes the mind more peaceful. Now the other factor, the other thing which I would talk about is the vipassana aspect of meditation. And vipassana, as I said, is very often translated as insight. But there is another way to translate in this word, which I quite like, and that is seeing clearly. Seeing clearly, if you have a clarity in the way you look at the world, the way you look at things around you, that is essentially what insight is all about. So what is it that we're supposed to see clearly? And this is one of the wonderful aspects of Buddhism, that what we are supposed to see clearly is reality. We want to see the world as it actually is. And I personally find that so inspiring, that this is like the almost like the heart of Buddhism, that we're always trying to see the world as it actually is, instead of being deluded or being confused about what things are. The purpose of Buddhism is almost like science in a sense, because we are trying to understand how this world actually works, how we work, how the world around us works. So you want to see reality. You want to see things as they actually are. And of course, if you see things as they actually are, that is called wisdom in Buddhism. Because it's only when you understand things as they actually are that you can act wisely, that you can act in accordance with reality. If you're not acting in accordance with reality, you're likely to make mistakes, to do stupid things, because you don't understand the way things actually work. It's only when you understand the way things work that you can act in a way which is wise, really compassionate, and have real loving kindness in your heart. Because only then do you understand fully what's going on. There are some wonderful things that were said about the Buddha. The Buddha was said, for example, to be the eye of the world. And of course, the reason why the Buddha was the eye of the world, because he saw that reality. And that is what the Buddha's teaching is all about. He understood how things actually are. And then he can teach us exactly these ways so that we also can come to understand that reality. So the Buddha is almost like our eyes. He sees for us. And then he tells us, this is the way it is. If you want to understand what this is all about, this is the way you should practice. So you can also see that reality. The Buddha was also called the one who draws away the veil in the world. And of course, if something is veiled, it means you cannot see it very clearly behind the veil. The veil obscures things. So the point here is that the Buddha drew away that obscurity to show us the way things actually are. So this is what vipassana is about. Vipassana is about training yourself to see in accordance with that reality, the way things actually are. And then you have the possibility of wisdom, of actually acting in a very positive, very good way for the world around you. So what is it? What is the way the world actually is? What did the Buddha say about these things? And there's three or four qualities that the Buddha would always mention that he talked about. And these are, for you who have been Buddhist for a while, you will know these things, of course, impermanence, suffering, and non-self. These are often called like the three characteristics of existence. And this is what we are focusing on when we want to do this clarity of mind, the clarity of vipassana practice. Seeing clearly is about understanding how things are impermanent, how things can be suffering, and how things are non-self. That is what it essentially is all about. So these are the things that we should focus on if we want to do vipassana practice. And so vipassana practice is basically training yourself to look at the world in terms of these three characteristics, seeing that things around you actually are impermanent, how things always change, nothing is stable, it's always going from one state to another state, and never at all being stable, even for the slightest period of time. And then to understand that this is also tied up with suffering, because if things are always changing, and we always attach to things, we always hold on to things, because we hold on to something which is changing, we are bound to be disappointed. And this is a very important aspect of suffering in the world. And also the idea of non-self. The idea of non-self is, of course, that if something is impermanent, it cannot be a permanent I inside. That negates the idea of a permanent self. So this is how we need to look at the world, need to look at things around us. And I will give you an example, because sometimes it can get a bit abstract if we just talk about these things in this way. And I will give you an example of what I sometimes do in the monastery. It's a very simple example, and it's a very small thing. Sometimes in the monastery, I've been engaged with the building work in our monastery. We build all these little huts in the forest for the monks to have a place to stay and do their meditation practice and the study. And usually I've been involved with that building work in the monastery. And I remember my mother told me when I was 2 years old, I would usually stand in the window and I would look out at all the machinery digging in the ground outside. And she said I could do it for hours on end, apparently, when I was really, really tiny. And it was obvious to me afterwards that this must have been an obsession of mine, probably something I brought with me from a past life. And now sometimes I can see that same obsession still happening in the monastery. You get really carried away with that building work. And then I remind myself, hold on a second, look at this building a bit more carefully. What is going on as I'm actually building this building here? And what you often find is that as you are actually building this building, things are already going wrong. Things never go exactly according to plan. Something breaks, something falls apart, something is not quite right the way it should be. Things are never as perfect as we would like them to be. And then not only do they start to fall up, not only doesn't things work exactly right, but as soon as you put it up, sometimes it starts to fall apart already. Sometimes just little things which fall off or go down or don't quite work out. It's amazing how quickly even the strongest buildings start to fall apart sometimes. And then I remind myself that, what about 50 years from now? What is it going to look like? And of course, I know what it's going to look like. Well, maybe not 50 years, but certainly 20 years. Because some of the oldest huts in the monastery are already 20 years old. They are falling apart. The wood is getting full of termites being eaten up. It needs to be revarnished because the varnish is falling off. The bricks sometimes start to become a bit brittle. Somebody hammers a nail in the wall and part of the brick falls out. And it's just continuous. It starts to collapse slowly, stage by stage. It collapses. Then I think, what will it be like in 100 years from now? What about 200 years? What about 500 years from now? And chances are that 500 years from now, there might be a little pile of bricks lying on the ground. And that was that beautiful hut, that beautiful kuti, which I put up 500 years ago, is now reduced to a pile of rubble on the ground. And that is such a useful perception for me, because when I think like that, it takes so much of the obsession out of the building work. It takes the franticness out of it, and it makes me much more peaceful with what I'm doing, because I recall this is going to fall apart. This is not going to last forever. There is a delusion in me, or maybe in many people, that when you do building work, that you are somehow progressing, you're moving forward, you are kind of establishing something. And there's a delusion that this is going to last for a long time, maybe forever even, while you're doing the building. If you remind yourself of the impermanence, it takes out so much of that delusion, and it leaves you much more peaceful, much more at ease. And it doesn't actually stop with that, of course. Eventually, there will be nothing left of the monastery whatsoever. And one day, some kind of archaeologist might come in there and pick up the ruins and find out that, 1,000 years ago, there was a Buddhist monastery here, believe it or not, in Australia, far away from the origins of Buddhism. And even later on, maybe 2,000 years from now, somebody will come and they will see, they won't even recognize that it was a Buddhist monastery. All they will find maybe is a little bit of rubble somewhere, a little bit of maybe ancient rusted iron left behind. And they will say, there was something here, but we have no idea what it was. And at that point, the whole monastery, the whole Buddhism, everything will have been erased completely from the memory of that society here. And that is how powerful impermanence is, how it sort of destroys, in a sense, everything. There's nothing at all left behind. And the wonderful thing is that when you think like that, when you reflect like that, you release some of the attachments that you have inside yourself. You understand the impermanence. You understand that you cannot hold on to this. It is stupid to grasp onto this. Let it go. Let it be. And just be peaceful with it as you go along. And this is the purpose of insight. This is the purpose of seeing clearly, of vipassana, that we are able to let go of things when we understand that they are impermanent in this way. We understand that holding on to something which is impermanent is going to lead to suffering in the future. Why do we want to hold on to something which is suffering for ourselves? And the simile which is often used is that when you see that something is impermanent, that is a bit like putting your hand on a hot plate. You think the hot plate is cold, but in fact it happens to be hot. Soon as you put your hand on it, you automatically retract that hand. You don't have to think for yourself, this hot plate is hot, I must pull it back. It happens automatically because it's just an instinctual feeling that you put it back. And it's exactly the same thing with vipassana or with insight. When it works, you actually are able to see the impermanence of something, the problem in something, the mind withdraws from it automatically. You don't have to think, I should withdraw from this. It just happens by itself. And that is the beautiful thing about it. And then when you withdraw that attachment, when you withdraw the craving for this object, whatever it is that you are seeing as impermanent, then how do you feel afterwards? You feel peaceful. Because that is what the mind does. When you don't have attachment, don't have craving, you feel peace inside of yourself. That's just what I was saying before. That if you have craving, if you have desire, the mind will always go after those objects of craving and desire. The mind will always go out into the world. The same thing with irritation, anger, and ill will. The mind goes out. So when you let go of craving and attachment, the opposite happens. You feel peaceful. You feel calmer. And now you can start to see here how vipassana and samatha go together. The point is that if you do vipassana correctly, it leads to samatha. It leads to calm. Seeing clearly always leads to calm. That is how you know you have succeeded in seeing something clearly. And at the same time, if you are successful in your calming meditation, if you do your loving kindness, you're watching the breath, and you are successful in being peaceful, well, as I said before, the calm takes away the defilements of the mind, the anger and the desire, because anger and desire distorts the way we look at the world. And to see how anger and desire distort the world, there's the ancient saying that, it is just as when you know when you do something when you're angry. If you do something when you're angry, very often you regret it afterwards. But while you were angry, it seemed like the right thing to do. So what is going on there? How come you regret something afterwards? But at the time you were angry, it seemed right. What's going on there? And it's very simple. The reason is because when you're angry, your mind is distorted. You don't see things properly. And because the mind is distorted, that is why you do things in the wrong way. So the point here is that the less anger you have, the less desire you have, the more you will see clearly, the more clear your mind will be. And when those things get eliminated completely, well, that is when you can see absolutely clearly. So because the Samatha meditation, because the calm meditation leads to a reduction of these defilements of anger and desire, it also allows you to see more clearly. So in this way, you can see how the Samatha leads to Vipassana, how the calm leads to the potential for insight and clarity. And now you can begin to see how Samatha and Vipassana are not so much separate things, not individual entities. You do either one or the other, but they actually work together in a very beautiful way. One leads to the other, the other leads to the one, and then they build each other up, stage by stage by stage, as you become more and more peaceful, as you attain more and more insight, as you see more and more clearly what the world around you is actually like. And this is the beautiful thing with this mental cultivation, building each other up stage by stage, one thing together, 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 all the way up to full enlightenment. So therefore, I always feel, this is my personal opinion, but I always feel that it's a little bit misleading to say that one goes on either a Samatha retreat or a Vipassana retreat, because all retreats really are both. And I know myself that when I listen to Ajahn Brahm, for example, teach in the monastery, he always uses Vipassana to help you attain calm in your life. And he always uses calm to help you reach Vipassana, reach insight and seeing clearly. So even Ajahn Brahm teaches insight. He doesn't just teach Samatha or calm. And the same thing, if you go on the Vipassana retreat, you will soon realize that a large part of the meditation they teach in this Vipassana retreat is very often nothing else but watching the breath, making yourself peaceful and calm, so that you have the opportunity to see things more clearly. So these things are the same thing. Not the same thing. They are very closely related. It's just a slightly different way of looking at things, and then the result of these two is the same. Clarity, seeing clearly, insight, and calm. They go together, hand in hand, step by step, stage by stage. So now you can see how these things are almost the entire path of Buddhism. I should maybe also say briefly that virtue, morality, sila is also part of this practice. Sila, in a sense, is nothing else but a kind of calming and samatha-ing of the mind. Because when you are virtuous, when you live a moral life, you're calming down some of the defilements in the mind. You're not allowing your desires and your angers to run riot. You're controlling them, holding them in check. That is what keeping the five precepts is all about, reducing the defiled states of mind. So this is an aspect of samatha-ing, of calming down the mind. And of course, virtue and morality in Buddhism also has to do sometimes with mental virtue, mental morality, that we don't even allow our minds to become too filled with hatred, with anger, and with desire. And of course, in this case, it is very direct the way that we actually calm down the mind and make it more peaceful. So in this way, even virtue can be seen as an aspect of samatha, of calming things down. And in this way, the whole path from the beginning to the end is nothing but calm and clarity, all the way to the very end. So now I want to talk a little bit about how we can actually use this in our daily life. What can we actually do? What are some techniques that we can use to develop some insight, develop clarity, and also develop samatha in our daily life? But to understand this, I want to actually start from the point of enlightenment. It might be interesting for you to know a little bit what actually happens when you get enlightened, and then bring it back from there so that you can actually see what we have to do to actually move in that direction. When you start from enlightenment and you take it backwards to its causes, you can see how you can actually in your daily life put in place the causes and conditions for that enlightenment to eventually happen. And to become enlightened, there is the final thing which makes enlightenment possible, which leads to enlightenment, is insight. It's a clarity of vision is the final thing which actually is required to become enlightened. And of course, for enlightenment to happen, that is a very, very profound type of insight. Essentially, what it means is to see everything here, everything in existence, as subject to these characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And when you see that, that is when enlightenment happens. But what is then needed to become enlightened? And what is needed to become enlightened is an extremely peaceful, calm, a mind free of all kind of defilements, a very beautiful and radiant mind, which doesn't have any kind of distortions inside of it. Remember, the distortions come from desire and anger. So remove the desire and anger and build up peace and tranquility. And then you have a mind which is capable of reaching enlightenment. And this can only happen when you develop this very, very deep state of meditation known as samadhi in Pali language. It often translated as concentration or peace or stillness and many other words which can be used for translating this. But it has to reach a very, very profound level. So in daily life, it's very hard to actually expect to reach these kind of stages of stillness in daily life. So what instead we should be doing is we should do a practices which go in the right direction, which point us towards that stillness, so that eventually one day, maybe when we go on retreat, when we have some extra time for ourselves, then we can maybe try to achieve these very powerful and deep states of samadhi for ourselves. So what we should be doing in daily life then is to prepare ourselves for that time when those deep stages of samadhi can happen. So we should do samatha practice and vipassana practice, which is pointing us in the right direction. And then, eventually, one day, we may have an opportunity to gain these deep states ourselves. And on the samatha front, the meditation, which is basically is about calm, of course, the initial thing is to just keep a very good, virtuous behavior, because, as I said, this is already part of the calming practice. So if you can be virtuous, if you can do good, and you can maybe increase that virtue and goodness over time, then you're already making yourself more peaceful and more calm. And then if you get into meditation practice, then you can try the breath meditation, because as I said before, this is the most powerful type of meditation taught by the Buddha. And if you can do it, great. If you can't, don't be too concerned about that, because it's a difficult type of meditation. And the majority of people are going to struggle to do the breath meditation properly. So don't feel bad if you can't do it. It is almost to be expected that at least initially you will find it difficult to follow to do the breath meditation. So often it might be more useful to do something like loving kindness meditation, because loving kindness meditation, as I mentioned before, is also a kind of calming down the mind. And the beautiful thing about loving kindness meditation, in addition to calming the mind, it leads to so many beautiful and wonderful qualities inside of you. It makes you so happy and so feel so good about yourself. And it makes you want to be kind to the world, want to be good to the people around you. And of course, all that just reinforces your morality, reinforces your virtue, and it makes the whole path so much more easy if you can do that loving kindness meditation for yourself. So it's a very, very powerful technique. And not only that, but it was also praised by the Buddha in many of his discourses, many of his sayings. He said this is a wonderful way of overcoming defilements, of sleeping well at night, of even being guarded by supernatural deities, if you like. All of these and many more are the great advantages of doing loving kindness meditation. So I'm not going to go into too much about how to do it, but just to give you a very brief hint about how to do loving kindness meditation. The most important thing is, first of all, just to establish seeing the good things in what you are want to have loving kindness towards. And that is why you will have noticed before in the meditation we did before here, before I actually start, you know, saying, may all beings be happy, etc., before you say that, you have to establish a perception inside of you that these people, these beings that you radiate in kindness towards, that they are good people, that they have, that they are good intentioned, maybe not perfect people, but they are good, have good hearts, doing the right thing. Because it's only possible, really, to wish somebody well if you have a good feeling towards them. And that's why I use perceptions like, well, think about how fortunate you are to have all these people around you who are doing the same thing as you are doing. Because that gives you a sense of good feeling about the people around you. So that is one of the most important starting points, as far as I'm concerned, to be able to do loving kindness. Make sure that you, first of all, establish a positive perception inside of yourself of that object, of that person, of that animal, whatever it is that you want to wish well. And then you can move on to wishing these beings well. I'm not going to say any more about that because it's getting a little bit off topic. Yeah. You can also do other things to calm your mind. As I mentioned before, you can just recollect the nature of the Buddha, for example. You may be the kind of person who find great gratitude about the Buddha, about all the wonderful qualities of this master who lived 2,500 years ago. Or you can recall the Dhamma, this teaching that you have, which is able to guide you in the life, guide other people, guide us as a society to be better, to have more harmony, to have more kindness to each other and compassion towards each other. His wonderful teaching, which basically is all about happiness. How fortunate we all are to have found this teaching in our lives. Reflect on that and see if that maybe gives you a little bit of happiness and contentment inside. And these are techniques that you can use in your daily life to calm yourself down, to feel more peaceful initially. And then, if you have success, then you can maybe go on to the breath and get even deeper in your meditation practice. The other aspect is the vipassana aspect, the clear-seeing aspect. And how can we actually use this in our daily lives to enhance our meditation practice? And I will give you some examples, maybe some examples of each of these three characteristics we've been talking about, the characteristic of impermanence, suffering, and non-self. How can we contemplate impermanence, for example, in our daily life? And one very easy way of doing it is that you, for example, because of we all are going to have some attachment somewhere. One beautiful way of finding out where your attachments are is to stick all your belongings into your house and imagine your house is burning. What is the first thing you would rescue from that house? Now that is the thing that you are most attached to in your life, of your belongings. Now, then you can reflect on that thing. Well, this thing, this is the one I'm most attached to. Well, how permanent is it? How easily could it not get destroyed some way or another? The house could actually burn down. It would definitely get destroyed. It could get stolen. My kids could rip it apart maybe one day. Or almost anything could happen. A vast number of things could happen that this thing actually gets damaged and get destroyed. Why should I hold on to this so strongly? Why should I be attached to something which could literally disappear at any moment? And certainly you know for sure that when you die, definitely when you die, this is not going to no longer going to be yours. And in this way, if you come back home and you feel a bit distracted, your mind is a bit restless, you find it difficult to be peaceful, you can try this sort of vipassana practice, this kind of perception of the impermanence, and see if that helps you in actually settling down the mind. Because again, that is the purpose of vipassana, of clear seeing, is to help you settle down. That is the most important aspect of this, first of all. Then you can try the aspect of suffering, if you find that is useful in your life. And one way of using the aspect of suffering in your life is, first of all, to come to understand your own suffering in your life. Try not to be one of those people who says, oh, I don't have any suffering in my life. My life is really is perfectly okay. Because if that's what you think, it means you haven't really looked very deeply at what is actually going on. So get to know yourself really, really well. Look at your mind. Look at what happens during the day. Look at how often you have desires in your mind and see what a mind with desire actually is like. A mind with desire is not content because trying to find happiness somewhere else. That lack of contentment is a subtle form of suffering in your life. Anger, if you feel what it feels like to be angry rather than always look at the object of the anger, again, you will see that that is definitely, very clearly a kind of suffering. Restlessness, sloth and torpor, these are also types of suffering in your life. And then when you get to know yourself, to understand these things, then you also don't get so upset sometimes. Sometimes when we suffer, we get upset, we get angry. It's one of the natural reactions in life to a sense of suffering. It shouldn't be this way. Why do I have to suffer? It is wrong. But when you come to understand that this is part of being a human being, it cannot really be any different from this. When you look at yourself and you see the way it is, then you can also come to an acceptance. Okay, I'm going to accept this. And instead of getting angry, you just feel that sense of suffering inside of you instead. You don't go after it, be upset, think it shouldn't be this way, it should be some other way. And you can see how then you can extend that also to other people. You can extend that to see that not only you are suffering, people around you are suffering. And in this way, you can turn that suffering in yourself and the suffering that you understand by comparison is in all beings, all people around us. Turn it into compassion. Turn it into loving kindness for the people around you. So when people do something strange, do something funny, remember, very often they do things like that because of suffering, because of problems in their life. And you can turn that into compassion, into kindness, into something positive. This is a beautiful, simple way of using the idea of suffering in our lives to enhance our spiritual practice. How about non-self? Can we even use the idea of non-self in our life to enhance our spiritual practice? And it's a very simple, nice way of using non-self. This is one of the stories from Ajahn Brahm's book, Opening Door of Your Heart. I'm sure many of you have read that book already, maybe all of you, I don't know. And there's one story in there which is a very simple little story here. And it looks on the surface, it doesn't look very profound, but when you start to think about it, it's actually a very profound story here. And this is the story about some person who gets into the car, they're in a hurry, they have to get to a meeting, they drive off really fast, and then just as they come to a traffic light, it turns red. And they have to stop for this traffic light. And they get really upset, they get really angry. They start shouting at the traffic light, you stupid, terrible traffic light, how can you become red when I'm coming? I'm busy, you should know better than becoming red at this moment, you stupid traffic light. And maybe they get out of the car and they shake that traffic light and do all kinds of stupid things because they are so upset at being stopped. And of course the point here is that a traffic light is just a traffic light. There's a certain circuitry, there's a certain way that traffic light has been programmed to become red every 3 or 4 minutes. So how can one become angry at a traffic light? So normally we don't become angry at traffic lights. We are resigned to the fact that a traffic light does become red even when we don't want it to become red. Okay, it's suffering when it becomes red, but we accept it. We don't get angry and upset because the traffic light gets red. Now, the profundity of this simile is to understand that human beings around us are just like red traffic lights. Sometimes they get angry, sometimes they get upset, sometimes they do things they get towards it which are nasty, not kind, not compassionate, not what they should be doing. And the point is that this is what people do. It is not a personal thing, it is not that they are attacking us because we are bad. It is because something in the environment has caused them, certain conditions has caused them to do something which is not nice. They are just like traffic lights. There's a program running inside of them, and when certain conditions arise, it clicks. And then they do something which is stupid, do something which is wrong. And the point here, of course, the reason it is like this is precisely because of the Buddha's teachings of no self. Because there is no self, we are all completely conditioned by our environment. We are products. We're like robots walking around, being always subject to what is happening around us. And if we can see this in other people, it becomes so much more easy to forgive them, because we know that it's not actually their choice that they're doing something stupid, that they're doing something bad. They are conditioned by something outside of them. They're like red traffic lights. If we don't become angry at red traffic lights, we should not become angry and upset at people either. It's difficult to see this, it's difficult to understand, because this is a particularly profound teaching. But if you can see that, you're starting to get a very good grasp of what the core of the Buddha's teachings is all about, this idea of non-self, idea that there's nothing inside of here apart from things which are products of causes and conditions. So you can use that, and that is also a very helpful way of enhancing your spiritual practice. Now, so these are just little tools, little ways, but you can use anything, any kind of way that you find in your daily life. You can look at impermanence or suffering or non-self to help you see the world more clearly, to see things more clearly, ways that help you to calm you down, to make your meditation afterwards more powerful. All of those ways are valid ways of doing vipassana, of doing this calming and clearing of the mind. There's one last thing I want to talk about, and this is a very powerful tool. And some of you may not like this particular tool because it can be a little bit confronting. And if you don't like it, you don't have to do it. It's only if you feel comfortable about it that you should actually be doing these kind of things. But the reason I want to talk about it is because the Buddha praised this kind of contemplation a lot. He said it's a very powerful way of contemplating. And it combines, in a sense, in one contemplation, all the ideas of impermanence, permanence, suffering, and non-self in one thing. And it can, if it is used in a good way, lead to peaceful states of mind very quickly. And that's why I want to talk about it. And this is the recollection of death. To remember that we are all subject to dying, and sometimes we don't know when it's going to happen. Again, as I said before, if you don't feel comfortable with this, of course, don't do it, because then you may actually make things worse than they really are. But if you feel it is not so difficult, then it may be a powerful tool that you can use. And the point here is that in the face of death, if we know that we are going to die, and it could happen tomorrow, who knows, it could happen next month, we may have 20 years left to live, but even if we have 20, 30, 40, 50 years left to live, it's going to pass by so fast. Ask any old person lying on the deathbed, about to die, ask them about their life, and they're going to say, it passed like that, it's all gone. And this is exactly the same way we are going to feel when we eventually lie there, ready to pass away. So because of that, it doesn't matter so much. It's all going to happen very, very fast anyway. You might as well be dead tomorrow in many ways. So because of that, you can use that technique. And what happens when we see death clearly? What happens if we think that we might be dead tomorrow? It clears up the mind, because all the petty little things in the mind, all the petty desires, all the petty irritations and angers and ill will that we may have in life, why, when we're about to die, why on earth would we hold on to those things? It becomes so much more easy to let go of when we know that we are about to die. And I know many people, particularly people who have lived a good life, who have been good people, been compassionate and kind people, they often feel very peaceful during their last days, during the end of their life. And why is it that people like that feel peaceful during their last days? It is precisely for this reason, that they know they're going to die. They're going to have to say goodbye to all these people, all these things around them. They can't hold on anymore. They have to let go. In fact, they have to let go of everything, absolutely everything. All their possessions, all their friends, all their family, even their own body. The only thing they will have left is their mind. So because death almost forces letting go upon you in such a powerful way, just the recollection of death, just that idea that you're going to die, is going to help you enormously to let go if you're able to do it. So go back after a long day outside, you want to meditate, your mind is maybe not as peaceful as you would like it to be. Try But try. Why am I attached to all these things? Why am I thinking about what I should be doing at work? Why am I thinking about money problems? Why am I thinking about family problems? All these things are going to be gone anyway. Maybe they will be gone tomorrow. Who knows? So why hold on to these things? And see what happens inside of your mind. If you do it in the right way, you feel peaceful. You feel really calm because you let go. If you do it, if you're not ready for it, you might feel a bit anxious or find it difficult. In that case, try something else instead. So that is a very, very powerful technique. And as I said, the Buddha recommended this technique. He said, if you can use this, it can be very powerful and very beneficial for you, particularly if you do it regularly, so that you gain a kind of a ability to do this reflection in a way which is powerful to you. All these reflections, all these perceptions are things we have to train in to make them work. Nothing works straight away. We have to learn how to use them properly. So that is the Vipassana side of things. As I said before, if you do things these things properly, you will let go. You will feel peaceful. If you do the Samatha meditation, you start to feel peaceful. Then because you're letting go of all the defilements, your mind will become much more clear, much more powerful. And then you will start to see things clearly anyway after you come out of your Samatha meditation. So Samatha is Vipassana. Vipassana is Samatha. They go hand in hand. And the ancient famous simile that was used by Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher, was that it's like two sides of a knife. A knife has two sides. You cannot have a knife with only one side. One side is Samatha. The other side is Vipassana. They go hand in hand. Impossible to separate, really. And then, when you practice this in daily life, then when you finally go on a meditation retreat, you may be ready to experience something much more profound, some real samadhi, something which really gets you somewhere very far on the path. And then, when you get that real samadhi, everyone will have that opportunity to actually see, really see reality as it actually is. See the most profound type of vipassana, of clear seeing, that there is to be seen. So that is the talk this evening. Okay, so does anybody have any questions or comments or anything you want to say? Yes? Detachment. Attachment. It's like craving, basically. Attachment is sometimes easy, maybe, to take an example of, imagine that you're somebody who's close to you, that they die. How do you feel? You grieve very often, right? You feel sad. That's because of attachment to that person. Attachment is a sense that something that you have, whether it's an object or a person, that they give you a sense of happiness inside of you. Right? Anything which you feel is going to give you something positive inside of you, whether happiness or pleasure or something, those are the things you will tend to attach to because they give you something positive inside of you. So if that thing which gives you something positive, if that gets destroyed, then you find out that you were attached to that thing. Make sense? Yeah?
Really, when it's gone,
that's when you know whether you were attached or not in the first place. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And it's very close to desire, very close to craving. These things are almost, not quite synonymous, but almost synonymous. So that attachment is involved with craving, the craving is involved with attachment. And all of these things have the same problem, that they distort the mind, the way we perceive the world. Anybody else have any comments or questions? Yes, at the back there. Yeah, that's quite right. That's a good question, because sometimes in all the types of Buddhism often use the term emptiness more than non-self. But it's interesting that the Buddha actually says, well, what is the meaning of emptiness? And the meaning of emptiness is that there is no self in the world. That is actually the meaning of emptiness. So emptiness and non-self are just two sides of the same thing, the same story. Things are empty precisely because there is no self. Because they're no self, they're empty.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho Bhagavān Buddhaṃ
Namasami.
Supadipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namasami.